Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Wandering Wanderer, a podcast that explores people's places and ideas. And I'm very excited today to be sitting here with Diksha Tind, who is an architect, an interior designer, landscaper, and the founder of Soraya EcoStay Art Cafe and Art Gallery. And I'm very privileged to be a guest at this EcoStay in Goa. So welcome to the podcast, Diksha.
Thank you, and I'm very excited about this also.
Could you please briefly introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your story, a little bit about Soraya, and how you got to where you are now?
So basically, I was quite a successful interior designer and architect, landscaper in the metropolitan city of Bombay. And then I had all these four children and decided that I didn't want to bring them up in the city and I wanted to bring them up in a nice green space like Goa. And so we decided to move to Goa. And after that, we have traveled all around the world because Goa wasn't economically viable for us at that time. So we kind of went everywhere. This was our base and worked from Goa through different parts of the world. And finally decided to come back and resettle in Goa about a decade ago again, and restarted my journey here once the children were grown up and all settled and everyone wanted to come back to Goa with me because this is where they grew up. Soraya became the new story of my life after resettling in Goa. And slowly and gradually, even my architectural profession picked up again in Goa. It became the kind of story where I would work at leisure for pleasure or for pleasure at leisure. So it wasn't like working like a 9-to-5 job like we would do in a metropolitan city. Since Goa had that chilled out vibe, we kind of settled in with that and we worked with it. So Soraya happened because we kind of wanted to create something out of our lifestyle. We live a natural lifestyle. We believe in organic, healthy. And so we wanted to introduce that into a conscious living lifestyle around us. And so Soraya was born. And creating Soraya was a journey in itself. The journey was beautiful. And we still keep creating. So every time we have people coming back to Soraya, it has evolved even more and it's always changing. But there's always something to do. And being an architect, this is my playground, which is not a very happy situation for everyone around me because I'm constantly doing something to the space and it's constantly changing. But it's a beautiful journey and I've been learning through it from all the people who passed through Soraya, because we have a lot of people coming in and moving out of Soraya as volunteers from different parts of the world. And so we have a learning journey even with our guests and volunteers and people who pass through Soraya. Mm-hmm.
So if we just go back to what you were saying earlier, you mentioned that you lived all around the world. Yeah. So where have you lived and worked?
So yeah, after Bombay, we kind of moved to Saudi Arabia because I just had my two children after the first child. So that was like three children in a row. And I thought it was time to take a break from work and just be a mum and a wife. So Saudi Arabia, it was the golden cage,
yes.
Which wasn't too bad because it was a Club Med life while the children were just growing up and it was a little slow and restricted for business, as one would say, as a woman. But that at that time, I was just concentrating on being mom and wife. And so that was Saudi Arabia for about 6 years. Then prior to that, it was Madagascar. My husband was a pilot, so he had a job with Air Madagascar. Then he had a job with Saudi Airlines. And so with him, we kind of traveled through these parts of the world. Post that, I was very excited about how Dubai was developing as an architect because it was suddenly having all these islands in the sea called the Palm Island, the tallest building in the world called the Burj, Dubai. And so, I mean, I was excited about kind of experiencing the epitome of architecture in a very exciting city at that time for me. And so I went there and spent a few years there. I worked on some very challenging projects like Shangri-La Hotel, etc., and a lot of banks and other projects that kind of came my way while I was there. And I project managed in a big way as well. That was my forte. So that was interesting. It was a good stint in my life.
Coming, what years were you in Dubai?
Post the 9/11.
Yeah.
Because I remember 9/11 happening when I was making my plans to move to Dubai. And I was in Bombay at that time, working on the Marriott Hotel in Bombay. Prior to which, I worked at the Marriott Hotel in Goa, so it kind of was like a stepping stone to the next Marriott. And then I thought, yeah, I needed to fly a little further into a very fast-paced kind of life, which was Dubai. So it was 2003 onwards in Dubai.
Yeah. I was there 2004
wow.
to 2006, so
oh
we were
God.
There at the same time.
Lovely.
What
okay.
an interesting time to be in Dubai.
Yes, it was crazy, and it was amazing time to be there, actually, yeah.
Yeah, that you still had much of the old, you know, Bur Dubai, and you still
yes.
had very cheap food if you wanted it,
right.
but you also had this luxury coming up.
Yes, and so we were seeing a growth spurt in Dubai at that time. And then suddenly there was a big drop and everyone was leaving because the real estate went so expensive and unaffordable. So a lot of people kind of migrated out of Dubai at that time. And that's when I also left and came back to India. And I decided to come back, of course, to Goa. But now that I have been in Goa for so many years post that time, it's very difficult for me to even imagine going back to that lifestyle of Dubai. Because this is so, so very different from that I think I've passed that stage of the fast pace, and I'm very happy to be in this chilled out space and pace. So yeah, it's another journey to be here. Mm-hmm. And once you're in this journey, it's very difficult to go as like a sponge, you know, it just kind of takes you in, and then you just don't want to leave from here, you know.
It's like the land of the lotus eaters, you know, you can never escape.
Okay.
And I'm finding it difficult myself, having been here 2 months. I could definitely live there for long. Okay, so you went from Dubai, which was at the forefront of architecture at that time, came back to Goa, and you founded Soraya at that point. Is that
That's right?
Right,
yes. I came back for a while, and I kind of had a bit of a sabbatical, took a back seat, did some farming, spent some time just doing not much, and then it was time to get started once again with something that made sense, something that had a goal, something that took me into a space where I was busy again with things I enjoyed doing, basically. So that's how Soraya was born, because I loved cooking, and so the family said, why don't you introduce all the food that you cook for us into a cafe? And I did that. And then everything else kind of emanated around it. And we had this almost 300-year-old mansion here, which got restored again. And I said, what am I going to do with the space? Okay, let's just open an art gallery kind of story. So that's how that was born. And then we had space at the back with coconut trees and said, okay, let's do an eco stay here. So it was very like, you know, evolutionary.
Organic. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just like flowing. You know, it wasn't like pre-planned, and I stood among the trees and I said, okay, so I'm going to have this mud house here, and I'm going to have this tree house here, and I'm going to have a dormitory here, and we'll go from this tree to this tree, and we'll put this tree inside the house, and we'll put this outside the house, and we'll have a pond here. It's so nice to have a water feature. Blah, blah, blah. So we started digging, and we went deep, and I mean, once you dig in Goa to about even 2 meters, you hit water, mm-hmm. because the water table is pretty high and the water was sweet, and that was exciting. And then we discovered the soil, which was very chewing gummy, mm-hmm. which was perfect for mud houses. So I had all these laborers who were with me from Uttar Pradesh and Bihar, and they were saying to me, why don't you just make a mud house? And it was always a dream for me to make a mud house. So originally it was just like, I'll just do 10 century houses. And I said, no, let's go for the mud house. Mm-hmm. So then it just kind of completely changed. And we started building the mud houses. And then we just kept digging the pit, you know, deeper and deeper. And we finally reached 15 feet deep. And we got the best soil that didn't need treatment, didn't need anything to be done to it. Just made into walls and thrown to create a wall. And so all the four mud houses were born from the property, from the soil within the property. No material was brought from outside. Everything happened in situ.
But this wasn't planned. This was a happy accident.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was just very, very organic. I mean, it was crazy the way it was so unplanned, and it just kept moving with this beautiful flow, which was keeping everyone happy. And all my son's friends came from Bangalore. They were all volunteering, walking around, carrying soil, dropping it from the center to the side. And I mean, everyone got in project, and it was so much fun, mm-hmm. you know.
I'm very lucky to be staying in one of the mud houses. In fact, the mud house, which has the huge tree in the center of the space,
yeah.
And it really is a wonder to behold. I've never stayed anywhere like it. The entire interior is fashioned with mud, so the seating area, the bed is on a raised platform of mud. The bathroom, everything is mud with branches for support, and you have corrugated metal for the roof with netting. There are glass bottles inset into the walls, which I'd like to ask you, are they purely form or do they have a function as well?
So the glass bottles, first let me correct you about the roof. So the roof is not metal, it is recycled Tetra Pak sheets. So that is very interesting because that was a very happy accident we came across when we found somebody was using that. And we said, this is the answer to our roofing problem. And prior to that, we had plastic and thatch and coconut tree leaves on our roofing, which was not at all practical, because every time a branch fell from the tree on top, it made this, went like a rocket down and made a hole right through the plastic, and then it was another nightmare. Oh, the rain's going to come through that hole kind of story. So that was a very, very temporary roof. And then when we found this, it was like a dream come true. So it was amazing. Also the fact that it is a recycled product of Tetra Pak, which is completely non-biodegradable for hundreds of years. So this roof is going to be living past my great-grandchildren, I'm sure, if the structure still exists. But this is amazing as a roof material because it reflects the heat off by 10%, plus it is waterproof, and it is strong, because when we have coconuts falling off the coconut trees on top of the roof, they just kind of bounce off like balls. And so it has many advantages. And so that's the roof. Then we come to the bottles. The bottles are glass bottles that kind of create a hollow wall as such. So besides the mud wall, which automatically creates insulation from the weather outside, so it's hot outside, it's cool inside, it's cool outside, it's warm inside kind of story, the bottles also create a similar function because it's hollow. Essentially, it's a hollow wall, and the bottles also function as a structural strengthening part of a wall because the hollow bottles create strength in a wall. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a structural network, I would say. So, and it's interesting to make it so it creates a lot of light effects inside the room when when the sun is going up and it's hitting the bottles at various heights. You have the light of the bottle, if it's brown or red or green, you have those colors dancing on the floor with the rising sun or the, you know, setting sun, depending which part of the room the bottles are in and which way the sun is hitting it. So that's another interesting factor with the bottles. And also the fact that it's a recycling material, you know, so anything that's recycled, upcycled, saving the planet, creating less garbage is very interesting to me to incorporate into my structures.
And so were you inspired by projects you'd seen that incorporated Tetra Pak roofs and glass bottles within mud walls? Or is this something which came to you independently?
I knew that glass bottles are used for walls and stuff like that, so it wasn't something that I didn't know about. It wasn't something that I discovered or created. But everything that happened here came out of my head. It was just like something that was waiting to spill out. And it was just done standing there on the side, looking at the property and saying, yes, okay, this is how I want the wall to be. And of course I made a few sketches because I wanted to create kind of wind tunnels in the space. So I built in some areas, didn't build in some areas, created tunnels so that I would have wind coming in through the paddy fields and traveling in certain directions. So that kind of went through and through the property. And so I was like kind of quite a dreamer on the property, sitting, looking at the trees, looking at the property, sitting inside the structures while they were being built and imagining how I would want it. And when I built the structures, I felt I need to live in this room and I need to love it. So that's how it all kind of started. And this is how I want it to be for me. And so I made it the way I want it to be for me. And that's how it went forward, you know. So even sitting in the tree houses, looking out at the paddy fields, I was sitting on the tree house on the height of a bed and looking out, and I said, that's how I want to look at the paddy field. So I'm going to bring the window right down so that while I'm sitting in this tree house, I can look out sitting here and enjoy the beauty of that paddy field with the peacocks dancing and stuff like that, you know.
Well, I can say that having stayed in the room now for 2 evenings and seen the space and walked around, you telling me that makes a lot of sense, because it seems like a lot of thought has gone into the beauty and peace of the space. So I'm really interested in how that felt for you as an architect who'd worked on some fairly high stakes projects, to go from that process of designing hotels, project managing big projects, so then having your own space. How did that process differ, and how has that changed you as an architect and designer?
I would say I haven't really changed as an architect and a designer. If I have to design something high-end today, I'll very happily do it, you know, because I'm a designer. I can create anything, you know, out of anything. So here I created out of sticks and stones and mud, and there I can create with glass and steel. And so you have to have that thought process in your head where you can do anything with anything, and you have to be malleable as a designer to do that. So it's not like I have changed, it's just that I have that in me as well, and I have this in me as well. But this is who I am inside of me, and that is also who I can be inside of me, because as a designer you have to have that width of vision, you know, I would say, to be able to do everything, you know. I mean, I would love to do something galactic, you know, like also, because that is also like, wow, you know, that's something in the far future, but the structures are so ergonomic and you know, it's another vision altogether. So yeah, I think I'm a very open person when it comes to design.
I suppose what I'm really fascinated about is the time that you allowed yourself to come to your ideas here at Soraya. Whereas when you're employed on a project, you're quite time-bound, I would imagine.
That is very true. I feel that the more time you spend on a project, it kind of hones, you know, it gets better and better. And the more you think about it, the more you, you know, work with it, it just gets better and better with time. I've realized that. And but also the beauty of this is that when you are working on a project and you're not just designing and leaving it to someone else to kind of build, when you're involved in the process of being a part of the build, then you can hone it even while you're building, you know. That is a specialty of having the skills of being a project manager and a designer and a consultant and a specialist, so that you can get into the project during the build and kind of, you know, make special effects to what was already created.
Have an ongoing impact.
Yes.
And is that always how you worked as an architect? Have you always sort of project managed to a certain extent and been involved in your projects?
Always.
In an ongoing way.
Yes. I've never done something long distance where I've worked and something is happening somewhere and I really don't know how it's going. You know, it's so important to be personally involved in everything and be right there with the project.
Mm-hmm. So you like having creative control?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
For those without the context, including me, how do architects usually work? Or are there different ways that architects work? So you're quite heavily involved in the entire project from conception to completion, but are there architects who are completely uninvolved in...
Yeah, there are architects who will just do a project design and then it will be handed over to the structural consultant who will do the structural for it and then come back to the architect to finally approve what he has done. And then it goes forward to a contractor, and the contractor takes charge, and then you have, in India we never had the project management team, but now we have a project management team. Normally it was mostly an international standard of having project managers, architects, designers, contractors, but in India now I have noticed that since the size of the projects are massive and the designers are from all over the place, the project management team has come in. But there's a lot to say for that. What happens sometimes with the project management team, especially if it is not involved with the architect or a very, professional team, then it becomes more like a government office where it becomes very bureaucratic and it is just not helping the project to move forward. It is just being an obstruction to the project or being a very corrupt part of the project. So that could be a corrupting force or it could be an efficient force, depending upon who the project management team is. But yeah, that is how a lot of projects do happen in India. Not many architects are involved in the project as such. But we've had a lot of architects in the past who have been part of the project team, like they have gone to the site, helped to in the build, taught the local people how to create their own bricks and build with their own bricks, like Laurie Baker, who came to India and lived in Kerala and made homes that were affordable to the local people by teaching them how to bake their own bricks and how to, you know, make simple homes and make... there are a lot of architects like that have been a part of our profession, you know.
And do you feel that an architect has a social responsibility?
Definitely. I think every person on this planet has a social responsibility. And an architect has a very big influence since you are creating dwellings and creating structures that are going to house people or that are going to create social networking. I think definitely we have, because then we can speak through our structures and we can influence people and create an effect from the structure or the space, you know, where people live or congregate.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you think architecture intersects with other disciplines? Or in other words, what do you think is the best case for architecture intersecting with other elements to create these spaces that function in the best possible way for their users?
So I think an architect should definitely be involved in the interior design of the space, because it shouldn't be another professional who comes in and says, oh, I just have these walls and I have to work with them. The architect should think about how the interior space will work and therefore create the external space for it, and also needs to think about how we can create passive structures where we are using less electricity and, you know, creating more conscious living spaces rather than spaces that just are structures where you just throw in the lights and, you know, stuff like that. And landscaping also, I mean, the inside, outside, outside, inside, the new wabi-sabi kind of thing that's becoming so fashionable, which is a very nice way to create a structure, because you bring the outside inside and take the inside outside and you kind of integrate the two, and that becomes such a beautiful space then, which is becoming fashionable now.
And for those who don't know, including me, can you explain a little bit what this wabi-sabi concept is?
It is like you create a space which is not closed to the outside, which is inviting the outside inside, and the inside is moving outside as well, you know. So you are kind of creating a landscape which enters your space, and you're creating a built structure that enters the landscape, you know, in that sense.
Are there any notable examples you could provide?
Off my head right
yeah.
now, not really.
It's quite early in the morning, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah. Really, I can't really think of anything. I think that Jeffrey Bawa, who was an architect who based himself in Sri Lanka, was very much a part of this concept of building his structures. Of course, at that time, wabi-sabi wasn't a fashionable word to use, but I think that he has this as a concept in most of the structures that he has built in Sri Lanka and in many other parts of the world. You know.
And do you think that Soraya, the accommodation spaces, encapsulate this concept?
To a certain extent, I would say yes. Yeah, but not completely, because I think the mud houses are quite an enclosed space. The tree houses, I would say, are more a wabi-sabi kind of space, but the tree houses are more kind of within themselves, you know, like a cocoon.
Yeah, the mud houses, yeah, absolutely.
So I feel that, yes, I should have kind of opened them up a bit into the outside, you know, which I think I might do.
Yeah, you've still got time to tinker, right?
Yeah, yeah, further evolution.
What are the biggest contributions you think architecture can make to society?
I dream about mass-scale housing, which would be something that would help us get rid of the slums, which is, I think, a very big dream. And I would love to get into a state where I could create a modular system so that it can be created and used anywhere in the world, wherever we have this, and make it affordable. So this is a dream as an architect, to come to a certain zenith of your profession where you feel that this is the best you can do. It's the biggest challenge. You can make it affordable. You can make it happen. You can make it modular. You can create it for many and still make it affordable. So if I could do that before I die, I would think I would achieved my purpose as an architect.
And so going to the problem of slums and the problem of living spaces, what are some of the issues with modern living spaces in your mind?
I think that the living room space is the dining room and the living room are completely not needed anymore. You know, I mean, you can make a family room. You know, the living room was a space where you had guests come and kind of have a sitting room where you entertained and stuff. We don't have that lifestyle anymore. Everyone's so busy working. You know, you just have a family room where most of the family normally hang out during the day, and then you have your bedrooms and you have, you know, your private spaces, your study room, your bedrooms, whatever, and a family room where everyone hangs out. So this dining room concept and living room concept, which is an ancient concept which went with a lifestyle that belonged then, doesn't need to carry on being designed in the same now with a lifestyle that doesn't fit into that. It's just a room that I will come sit down and read a newspaper in, or now sit with his mobile.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids will be probably in the family room watching TV. Mm-hmm. So it's just another space which doesn't have a function anymore, I feel.
So Goa is so rich in terms of architecture. It's It's unique in India, I think. I haven't traveled across India, but from what I've seen and from what I've heard from others who have, Goa is quite unique, notably because of the 400-year history of Portuguese colonization. And the houses, the villas, the grand houses of old are really stunning. Some of them half rotting into the jungle, which gives them a sort of melancholic nostalgia, I think. What do you feel are the key features of Goan architecture, and how has Goa inspired you as an architect?
Yeah, these Portuguese houses, as they call them, are very interesting and very big attraction for a lot of people who want to move to Goa and they want to own one of these beautiful things. So prior to this immigration that happened into Goa, where people started moving into Goa and buying up these houses and restoring them.
When did that happen, by the way?
That started post-COVID.
Okay.
Because during COVID, people realized that Goa was one of the free country kind of spaces where they could come and live in a villa and have the freedom to move around in the garden and in the villa rather than be stuck in an apartment in a building in any one of the metropolitan cities and be in a jail. So this was a nice jail to be in while you were secured inside due to COVID restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also the fact that you could work from home made it easy for people to come to Goa, and it became a perfect place for everyone to move into, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So these houses are very attractive, and they are there's a variation to the houses in the sense like you will find an influence of the Christians and the Hindus on the architecture of the house. So when you look at the columns, you can say that this is an influence of a Hindu family because the column style is such. And this is the influence of a Christian family because the column style is such. So there are so many little effects of the house that can tell you what was the reason for the house being built, the way it was built and stuff like that. So as in the old days, you had this restriction on caste. So you had the Brahmins and the non-Brahmins. So the Brahmins were the upper caste, and the non-Brahmins were the lower caste. So they were not really allowed to enter the house from the front door. So they had to enter from the back door. So you had a back door for them to go straight into the kitchen, or the kitchen was an outdoor room. And the washroom was also an outdoor room, which was on top of a pigsty. So the pigs kind of fed on the... So, I mean, you had all those features that kind of became a part of this home. So most of these homes don't really have a kitchen and a washroom inside. They have become add-ons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because these were two outdoor structures in the old days. So you had the lower caste come in, cook your food and not enter your house. And then you had an upper caste person that would come in from the back door just to clean the house and go and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was... the lifestyle that kind of spoke of the structure, spoke into the structure, I would say. And besides that, kind of lost my thread here.
It's just talking about how you've been influenced as an architect by the architecture in Goa.
Okay, yeah, sorry, I really So, I found these houses really interesting because they're so different from anything else we've known before or seen before. And you come from a city like Bombay and you come from Dubai and come from all these other places where things like this don't exist. And so these are quaint and beautiful, interesting and different. And they have their drawbacks because, you know, you have these very tiny little windows, not enough sunlight coming in during the monsoon. It gets very... very dingy and stuff like
damp and dingy
mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But then, as if you're restoring a house, you can improve all those, you know, drawbacks. I feel, and the nice thing about this immigration has been that you've had people who are conscious about restoring these homes rather than breaking them down and making ugly buildings. Which is what was happening before they came, because before they came, people here were the builders, just thought that, okay, let's break down this old structure that is kind of crumbling and let's just make an apartment buildings where we will make so much more money, blah, blah, blah. Well, on the other hand, now you have people who are coming here who don't want to make these buildings and make money out of this. They want to create this and recreate and restore it so that they can occupy it and feel the goodness of it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's also an issue with people buying second homes in Goa and then leaving them unoccupied?
I think it's very, very selfish and unconscious thinking for people to be doing things like this. It's just so irrational. You're only thinking about keeping a space that you have taken away groundwater from. You have created a swimming pool for yourself, and you want to make this space lying around empty till you come to occupy it as and when you please. And you're taking away from somebody who's needy, you know.
But would these homes be occupied if the second homeowners hadn't bought the property?
So now you have Goans who are not being able to come back from wherever they have immigrated to and buy their own homes because property prices have jumped so much, and these people have made them just their second homes when they don't even have a first home to come back to. So I don't know what... I think it's an economic situation where you have the luxury to afford a second home, which you want to probably Airbnb or whatever. But Goa is not such a big place where you can afford to do something like this, you know. It's going to slowly fill up, and it's not fair to fill up with second homes. It's creating a bad economy, so that economy is just booming when you have time during tourist season, and then when it's not tourist season, it's like empty, and then suddenly the economy of the whole state drops. So it's a fluctuation in economy, which is creating the wrong statement to a lot of people. So you have, because of this, you have people from all over India who want to come and open restaurants in Goa, thinking that the economy is booming. But actually, it's just a temporary boom during a temporary space of time, when it is holiday season, when it is a long weekend, when it's blah, blah, blah. So that's the time when it's the peak for tourists, and that's when it fills up. And everyone thinks that, oh, you don't have a restaurant in Goa? Come on, man. You don't have a second home in Goa? Come on. You know, so it's become a status symbol to have a restaurant here or a home. So it's like talking about adding 50 people as a population in Goa and having a population of 150 restaurants for those 50 people. And that 150 barely fills up when you have that peak of tourist season. So it's like, what are you thinking?
So I think this brings us back to Saraya. Was one of your aims to try to contribute to Goa and to the local area?
That's how we started. We wanted this to be a community center. So we kind of had these little markets every month where housewives or people doing home, you know, homeware and having their own little garden and their own little vegetable garden, blah, 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 would bring their wares and sell it here and have a platform to be able to earn a little money through things they did at home. But now it's become fashionable to do that, and a lot of fashionable people are doing it with fashionable wares. So the local kind of story has begun to die out, except that now it has picked up in villages like Saligaon village, which is one of our neighbors, where they are reviving this, which is such a nice thing to see happening, because you feel that, yeah, somehow there has been some kind of an influence where something has filtered through and there is a revival to some of the efforts we tried to put in to harp on be local, buy local, live local kind of story. And it's filtering through and people are picking up on it, and it's becoming fashionable to do that now. So that's one way I think has been quite a good contribution into our environment here. You know? Mm-hmm.
And are there other ills in Goa that you see need to be fixed? So we talked about the economy being seasonal, which is difficult to fix because, yeah, of course, monsoon is a natural event which you can't change.
Yeah.
But are there other solutions to problems within Goa that you've thought about over the years?
Yeah, I think that we need definitely some kind of town planning to happen because it's growing so rapidly. And is haphazard. The infrastructure is not enough for the immigration that's happening. The immigration is haphazard. It's very niche, like, you know, certain villages are becoming occupied by certain townspeople. From somebody from Delhi comes, and then Asakao becomes a new Delhi, and people from Bombay come, and then Shiolim becomes a new Bombay, and, you know, different villages have different kinds of people moving in from different parts of India. And so those villages are becoming highly concentrated, and then slowly and gradually that concentration is spreading because there's no more land available in those villages. So it's very haphazard, and the groundwater is depleting. And I'm really thinking that we really need to put our heads together and get a town planning team that can solve problems before they become humongous. They are trying to make Goa into a smart city, and they think by widening the roads it's going to become a smart city. But while widening the roads, they are covering up all the rainwater drains. They're not thinking about the rainwater. Where is that going to go? You're just thinking about widening the roads. Like, what are you thinking? You know? It is so irrational, the way it's going. And it's definitely going to have repercussions on the people that live here. And it's one thing to stand up there and talk about what you did for Goa and where you're taking it, but actually it's just going downhill because you're not taking care of the main problems. We have a very, very high rainfall during the monsoons, and we have a big problem of flooding in our Panjim city, which happens every year during monsoons. And now what happened in Panjim is covered up all the rainwater drains, or they weren't deep enough to take it, and closed all the pathways between the canals, that the old canals that existed there, covered them up, blocked them up, took over the ecosystem of the backwaters, and just widened the roads into them. And just this road widening is happening, thinking that you are promoting a smart city without thinking about what is going to happen when natural calamities happen, which will happen every year because monsoons happen every year.
Sounds like there are a lot of issues. And would you be interested in being part of a town planning team for Goa?
Of course, I would be interested. We've had a very good team in the past, which has been very well-known architects, Goan architects who were part of the team. But the thing is that when you have something like this and you are concerned and working with a government, which is very bureaucratic, it can be very frustrating for people who cannot get things to move. The only way things would move is if you had an external team that came from outside India and sat on their heads and got it done. And then we became a part of that external team, because that, I think that that will probably have a bigger influence on our government, and it should be an autonomous body that should be allowed to make these decisions. The minute you come under a government body and you come under a bureaucratic setup, everything that you decide should be done can't really be done, because there are so many channels to go through to make it really happen in the end. So it is not, if it's not a scheme that is beneficial to people who would want to be benefited by schemes that are created to help the state.
So anyone involved in government in the planning area can reach out to you for your wealth of wisdom and ideas.
Oh, yes, of course. I'm always happy to.
Right. So last couple of questions. What are your future plans for Soraya, for this space, and for yourself?
Oh, so many people ask me this question. I don't really have an answer for that, because I'm always going with the flow, you know. And wherever the flow takes me, I go.
That's a great answer.
I don't have any plans as such. And it's like people ask me, like, where do you see Soraya 5 years from now? I never saw Soraya the way it is right now. 9 years back when I created this space, it has gone into something I didn't know it was going to go into. But I was just going with the flow all the time. So it's just very evolutionary, very organically evolutionary, and I'm leaving it to be like that. I really don't know where it's going to go because, you know, things around us also are changing so rapidly. I don't know what is going to happen in the future.
Great. And are there any recommendations that you can give to the audience? That could be books that you've read that are particularly impactful, could be movies you've seen that you think are life-changing.
I think that permaculture is life-changing because it creates a whole lifestyle that makes you suddenly very conscious about living the right way. And what is the right way and what is the wrong way? I don't want to be judgmental about those things, but the right way in the sense that it helps you to live with respect to the planet. Mm. And I think the planet needs a lot of respect now and a lot of care. And I think we should be the ones that should give it. And permaculture is going to take you there.
I love that the recommendation you've given is an avenue to open up another 45 minutes of talking. But we'll try not to do that. But what is permaculture, briefly?
So I would say permaculture, I'm not qualified to tell you what it is exactly because I am just a permaculturist by lifestyle, but not really officially done any courses or studied it.
You wouldn't
deeply.
Put it on your business card, for example?
No, I wouldn't, because I have a lot of permaculturists around me who have studied deeply, like my son and all the facilitators around him who have come every year to create permaculture courses here and workshops and retreats for people to come from all over the world to learn from here. So I wouldn't put myself in that category, but being there, watching them and living the lifestyle, I think I can speak a little about it and say that it is, first of all, in one line, life-changing because it makes you think about how you have lived and how you should live.
And can you define what it involves?
So basically, it is a recreation of how nature is. Like if you just look at a garden that is being taken care of by people where you are watering the lawn and you are kind of giving it care and it's still not green enough and certain patches are brown and blah, blah, blah. And you look at the forest right next to you, which is always green. Why is that? Because nature is taking care of it. And here you as a human are taking care of this and not perfectly taking care of it because you are not following the rules of nature. So if you follow the rules of nature is when you are living permaculturally. So what is happening in the forest here? The leaves are falling on the soil and they are deteriorating during the night when you have moisture and that mulch is becoming compost and then going into the soil. And the leaves, when they are covering the soil, they are protecting it from the sunlight and then they are becoming mulch, they're creating compost. The tree is going with deep roots down, bringing the nitrogen up, giving it and feeding it to the little bush next to it, which is then growing taller, and that is doing the same thing to the one next to it. And so they are not being watered, but the moisture from the ground is giving it what it needs. And the sunlight is giving it what it needs on top to the crown, and the soil is being protected at all times. So
it's designing natural spaces to take account for the space itself in order to provide a system which as closely mirrors how nature would function as possible. Would you say that's accurate?
Yes, I would say you're mimicking nature, basically. And
so how do you apply those principles at Soraya?
So you can be a lazy farmer.
Sure.
Because then you don't do anything. You just design it to make it perfect to mimic nature. So what we do is we have grey water, we have black water. So
and
the
what
gray
are the definitions
water,
of grey and black water?
So the grey water is water that comes out of your kitchen and that comes out of your showers. So that can be cleaned by sending it through a drain of pebbles and reeds and stuff like that. So you send it through a systematic natural system to
filter it.
Mm-hmm. And then it goes into your farm and it waters your system and stuff. The black water can be used for creating a biogas
And you know, what is black water?
Black water is what comes out of your toilets from the WCs.
Yeah.
And so that can't really, it can be filtered to a certain level and can be fed to a certain place, but not, maybe it can be fed to systems where you are not eating off the product, you know. But it has a high amount of nitrogen, it has a high amount of, a lot of special ingredients that would be useful for the roots of growing trees and stuff like that. And so, and it also can be used for biogas, which can be used for cooking purposes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so we are right now experimenting with our black water. We haven't reached a stage where we have the guts, I would say, to reuse it, because we are not too sure about how well we have created the system yet. We are in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Grey water we are using in all our spaces. We are not wasting any of it. We are doing rainwater harvesting. We even have an overflow of water from our overhead tanks once they fill up that goes back into our well. We have tried to create ponds all over the space where whenever we have rainwater, whenever we have the rains, those ponds fill up, and then we have, you know, the water going into our ground and, you know, replenishing the groundwater. So we are doing our best to take care of rainwater, rainwater harvesting, grey water. And this is what permaculture tells you to do. It's like a cycle. It's like a circle.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever comes out of your system goes back into your system.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really wasting anything at all. You're talking about solar. We have solar panels for our hot water system in the EcoStay. We are trying to go solar and completely sustainable, self-sustaining. In the near future, it's going to cost, but we are going to do it at some eventuality. I mean, if you say, what are your future plans? That is one of them.
Sure.
To be self-sustaining completely as far as possible, we are trying to create some amount of farm-to-table right now. We cannot be completely farm-to-table, but we are to a certain extent farm-to-table right now. The dream is to get to completely to farm-to-table at some time, which is ambitious, but it's a possibility.
It depends how vast your menu is, I suppose, or to
yes.
a certain extent.
And also how we want to limit ourselves so that we can create that eventuality. So yeah, we're looking at things like that. I would very proudly say that we do walk the talk right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
And in the future, I think we will walk the talk even more proudly once we have farm-to-table happening, once we have full self-sustainability with the solar panels and whatever else we might think might be suitable for us, you know, in the future.
That's great. Well, it's been very inspiring being here and meeting you and talking with you. And thank you very much for your time. I'm going to be including lots of useful links to all of the different topics we've been talking in the episode description for those who are interested, as well as links to check out Soraya, the space itself. So once again, Deeksha, thank you so much.
Thank you also for listening to me and taking this out to people to whom it might matter.
You're very welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye.